Welcome to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus with Bob Mendelson.
For the next 8 weeks, we're going to be studying the book of Ecclesiastes. There is nothing new under the sun. That's a big theme of it. We're going to talk about life. Now, we just finished a 21-week series on the book of life, the Gospel of John. And if you're listening online, you can listen to that on another occasion. But as we've pondered what text to study after the Gospel of John, the book of life, I called it, I thought we should go to something one of you suggested last week, and that is how to really find life in the Old Testament and the hopeless meaninglessness of life that the preacher uses in the book of Ecclesiastes is so contrasting both with what we've just studied and how he concludes his text that it'll be, I think, a worthwhile study. So we'll do this until Messiahmas. We're going to do this until the Thursday before Christmas, which we call Messiahmas. And that will conclude our year 2013. For those listening online in the year 2020, if Yeshua hasn't returned, you'll say, wow, 7 years ago, they were done doing this, and I'm in their class. Some people will be in our class right now. You are. And others are planning to join us. By the way, I've gotten emails from all kinds of people saying they want to come for at least one of the sessions during this time, including, but not limited to, Jewish people who don't yet believe. So we want to make them welcome and give them the Bible like we always do and help them out in certain things. So tonight we begin this 8 studies in the book of Ecclesiastes. And sermon number 1 is entitled, Life is Meaningless, the Monotony of Life. That is, there's nothing new under the sun. The monotony of life. When I think about the themes of Ecclesiastes, we get them straight away right here in our book, right here in our lesson tonight. It is the monotony of life, and you could hear the rhythm of going out and coming back almost like a tide. Ho, ho, ho is the sound of Christmas. Ho, hum is the sound of Ecclesiastes. Listen to this verse, verse 9. That which has been is all that will be. And that which has been done is that which will be done, so there's nothing new under the sun. That is the sound of hopeless monotony. And it's the usual rendering of the texts of the author, the king, who's experienced so much in life and yet found it wanting. Look what he says in verse 14. I've seen all the works which have been done under the sun, and behold, all is hevel, vanity, and striving after wind. No matter what we interpret the word hevel, it should be taken with the depth of meaning that Ecclesiastes attaches to it. And the word, the phrase, tachat hashemesh, under the sun, occurs 29 times in the book, which we call Ecclesiastes. By the way, the Hebrew word for Ecclesiastes is up there in green, Kohelet, and look at the first 3 letters, Kahal, congregation. Ecclesia, Ecclesiastes, Ecclesia is the Greek word for Kahal, a congregation, sometimes rendered church. So it is the person of the congregation, or nickname, teacher in your Bible, preacher in ours. It's the person who's the orator at the congregation. A congregational leader. Now, I say chapter 1's about monotony. Look at these ideas, and they're not limited to chapter 1. Verse 4, generations come, generations go. Verse 5, the sun rises, the sun sets, and really goes nowhere. Verse 7, seas have rivers, but they never fill up. The rivers come and go, but the sea never fills up. Look, we'll find out through the rest of the book that we cast our bread on waters, and they'll come back. Doesn't matter what we do, things seem to come back to us. Work happens and we're never satisfied. Money grows, but we never gain riches. We live life, but we don't really have life. These are the themes that keep haunting us in this text. Really, what's the end of the matter? What is the meaning of life? That might be the question that the preacher is trying to answer. Kohelet is trying to answer as an old man, for that's what most scholars say, he wrote this as an old guy, what is the meaning of life? And I suppose each of us here at this table and each of the people listening online are going through some kind of question sometime in their life. When you're in your teens, late teens, you're thinking maybe I'll go to uni. When you're out of uni, you say, why did I just do those 4 years? What the heck was that about? And what's the meaning of life? Which job should I take? Or should I go on to get a graduate degree? You know, you take a wife or you don't take a wife. You have a kid, what's the point of that kid? Why do I have 3 kids? And why do they scream? And why do I have to hold them every night? You know, these kinds of things. And then you hit your 40s. Sorry, you missed 30s. That happens. You know, you run into, they say life begins at 40. What they mean, maybe by then you've hit your stride. Maybe by then some people are still looking for the meaning of life. 50, you begin to not care what anybody else says. 60, you definitely don't care what anybody says. You become crotchety. That's the danger, and a little snarky. 70, you know you're on your last legs. There's all kinds of decadal realities. What happens when your children have children? You become a grandparent. That changes the situations of life. You move countries or you move cities. Your wife or your husband passes away, a life change, things change in life. And our constant question is, what's the point? Why am I doing this? I don't know if you remember Fraser Crane on the television, a very funny TV show with very sophisticated humor. And in season one, about episode 11, don't ask how I remember it, there is a moment when Fraser Crane, who's about 40 years old and a medical doctor and a psychiatrist, reads in the paper or finds out that one of his colleagues, not anyone he's ever met, a Jewish guy, has died. And he's about the same age and about the same circumstance in life. And Fraser goes into a what's the meaning of life question, as you would imagine. So he tries to figure it out and he says, I'm going to go over and visit that family. Now it turns out to be a Shiva. And he's never been to a Shiva. So he walks in, and 2 or 3 times in that episode, and you've got to watch the episode, YouTube it, or Hulu, or whatever you use, and find this phrase, you're not Jewish, are you? Because it's hysterical for us as Jews to watch this, as Fraser Crane seeks to find out why this guy, whom he claims to be a friend, but he's not a friend, he just wiggles his way into the Shiva. And he says, why did he die? Oh, he ate all those foods. Well, no, he never ate that kind of fatty food. And oh, he was an exercise nut, and he had low body fat, and all these things. And he's trying to find the meaning of life. And I think that's a good thing to do. Look, you see it in the movies, you see it in poetry, you see it in all of life. People saying, why am I here? Well, the preacher, Kohelet, did the same thing. And I think it's a worthy subject for us. And one of the things we have to do is knock back what is not life in order to find what is life. In other words, we have to disqualify things before we qualify things. Who can run for Prime Minister of Australia? Can anybody? Who can run? Can somebody in Taiwan run for Prime Minister? Why not? You have to be a citizen of Australia. Do you have to be a native-born citizen? I don't think so, but you have to be a citizen. Could you be a permanent resident and run for prime minister? No, you have to be a citizen. So there are disqualifiers before there are qualifiers. We haven't said a prime minister should be a person of note, a person of integrity, a person of clarity, a person who's a leader, who works well in teams, etc. We haven't given any qualifications. We've just given a first thing, which is a disqualifier. I don't know if you remember that there was an election in the U.S. in 2008, and Barack Obama won. And there was a big stink because he was questionably born in the United States. Was he born in Kenya? Was he an Indonesian Muslim? There were all kinds of questions about him. And the argument foisted on everybody by the internet and then voiced by Donald Trump, no less, was show us your birth certificate. And that's all it took. He ended up showing some birth certificate produced, I don't know what took so long, but he finally got one. And there, that quelled the noise, because the disqualifier in America is you have to be an American-born person to be president of the United States. You don't have to just be a citizen. So there are disqualifiers in every office. And when we look at what is the meaning of life, we have to look at things that we've identified as life and then knock them back, disqualify them first, before we find what the real thing is. If we did a survey out there on the streets and asked people, what do you think is a fullness of life? How would you describe life? Some would say, well, you know, parties, or having a lot of friends. Maybe it would be social status. Maybe it would be having a lot of money, or owning a home over there in Potts Point, or maybe a higher place, an apartment way up top so we can see the bridge during fireworks. Maybe it's a great education, or a chance to run the country, or a chance to run a company, or a chance to have a good family. All those things, whatever people might say. And the writer of Ecclesiastes, Kohelet, is going to throw all those up for investigation. Are those really life? And if not, what is? The commentary I read, and I think I'll stay with, is written by a guy named Roland Murphy. And he said this about this. He said, it is one interpretation among many, somewhere between Kohelet, the preacher of the absurd, and Kohelet, the preacher of joy. Not that he himself sought a middle way, thus contrary to a common interpretation. Kohelet remains as mysterious as his name, as the wisdom he sought and failed to capture. So who wrote this? Shlomo. That's commonly understood. According to rabbinic tradition, Solomon wrote this in his old age. But for various reasons, critical scholars have long rejected this idea. Where did I get that? Wikipedia. Wikipedia, the teller of all things true here, says the author of Ecclesiastes is presently a mystery. But for Jewish people, it's not a mystery. Solomon wrote it. So why do they say that? Listen to what Wikipedia goes on to say. Most commentators admit that knowing the date of Ecclesiastes with any certainty is impossible with the current available evidence. Even everybody I know, when I grew up, said it was written by Solomon around 950 BCE. Wikipedia says, a post-exilic date is the current consensus position among critical scholars. So somewhere in the 4th, 3rd, or 2nd century BC. What? Where do they get that? What do you do with the clear evidence internally of the text? What they say is that was written in by a redactor or an editor who says he's in the school of Solomon, or Solomon gave some wisdom that later became perpetrated, and it was combined into this edited version which we now have. And they even, on Wiki, say many evangelical scholars argue a pre-exilic date up to and including the time of Solomon, but this view has not gained wide acceptance among critical scholars. So what does that tell you about critical scholars and evangelicals? They're often at war. And if the date is a trouble, what about the text itself? What about the words and the content itself? That becomes more important. Just like that, dismissal. Well, let's look at the internal evidence. As you said, verse 1 says it's the son of David, and verse 12 says it's the king of Israel in Jerusalem. So those two facts limit the authorship to one person, Solomon. There's no mention of the name Solomon, so that's one of those arguments that the critics come up with, because Solomon names himself in Proverbs and Song of Songs, and even in the apocryphal Wisdom of Solomon. Well, that could be lost. All right, let's look at this subject, Hebel, vanity. 38 times in the text, in the whole book of Ecclesiastes, vanity is used. And in fact, I think there's a deliberate placing of it here, right here in verse 2. Vanity of vanities, all is vanity. And chapter 12 and verse 8, and you'll see that repeated. And look what happens in verse 9. It changes from I did this to third person. It changes from first person to third person. So chapter 12, verse 8 repeats the opening line. It's called in theology, it's called in literature, an inclusio. We would think of it like a parenthesis, an open paren on the left side and a closed paren on the right side. So when it starts with vanity of vanities, it ends with vanity of vanities, says the preacher, all is vanity. It's almost like a chorus, isn't it? It's almost like this is everything. It's the bookends to the conversation. It's an inclusio. What does the author want us to take away? You might know of Delitzsch, the great Jewish interpreter, Jewish believer, German, in the 19th century. He said this, "The whole Hevel, the whole vanity of the things, namely, which present themselves to us here below for our consideration and us, is vanity." So everything is vanity. Everything that he wants us to consider, the things that will be, we'll say it in our term, candidates for life, will be dealt with, considered, and will be knocked back. So let's go back to chapter 1, see this verse by verse. So we know, verse 1, that Solomon's the king, he's the author. Verse 2, when the Bible repeats, what's it doing? Amplifying. It's making it bigger, right? What other phrases have we read in the Bible that repeat? Nickname of Yeshua. A word of words. Okay, truly, truly, good. Verily, verily, same thing. Yep. Amen, amen, he said. So he's amplifying the veracity of what he's about to say. How about his name, King of Kings?
Yes.
How about Lord of all those who think they're lords? How about the place in the tabernacle where God dwelled? What was that called?
Holy of Holies.
So when the Bible repeats, it's amplifying the word. So when he says Holy of Holies, he's saying the holiest place of all. Here we see vanity of vanities. This is the most vain of all. This is vanity to the nth degree. This is Carole King amplified. Look, the vainest of all, and it's a summary of all of life. That could be hopeless. Let it suffice, Murphy says, to recall here that Hevel can be rendered in many different ways, as futile, absurd, useless, etc. It's obviously used in a derogatory or pejorative sense. Murphy goes on saying, Kohelet makes the term into a value judgment that he applies to various things and situations throughout his work. So that's what he's saying, vanity of vanities. There's nothing positive I'm going to spin about all this stuff that comes on. All right, verse 3. What advantage does man have in all his work? Yitron. Oh, let me say a couple more things. Some others have translated Hevel. It properly means breath or vapor, and hence can designate what is lacking in substance. It's ephemeral, without any result, as when paired with chase after wind or striving after the wind, right? We heard that phrase several times, and we'll hear it throughout the book. It was rendered in the Septuagint and the Vulgate. The Vulgate translated it vanitas, like Vanity Fair. Septuagint reference, mataiotes, vanity. These exclamations, these punches, are really tough to hear. It says that everything is hevel, everything is a waste, everything is futile. That bothers me a little. Doesn't it bother you? Shouldn't there be something redemptive about life? This sounds like a snarky old guy who's saying, I don't know why I did all that. You know, I've spent 75 years trying to find meaning and relevance, and I didn't find nothing. What a sad summary of life. Nothing is worthwhile. Nothing is of value. Well, did he really get wisdom? That's what we'll deal with when we get to the academic section. And did he live in the wisdom which he did receive? And what good is wisdom without living it out? That's a good thing he did. The king prayed for three things: an enlarged heart and wisdom and a way to sort it all out. He wanted that, and God gave it to him, but is that all that was necessary? So we'll deal with that when we get to it. What advantage does man have? Verse 3. Advantage. This word, yitron, only occurs in the book of Ecclesiastes, in the whole Bible. And it occurs 14 times. It might be translated profit or surplus. That's what it is in the Septuagint, periseia, surplus. So our version says advantage. What advantage does man have? He's not speaking about males, but rather humankind. What advantage do people have in all their work, which they do, you could say, under the sun? In other words, I don't know why I've been working. whoever this 50, 60, 70-year-old guy is, he says, I spent my days working. I toiled for what? So that I could earn, so that I could spend, so that I could earn, so that I could spend. And we hear this from people all the time who say, I don't know why I get up in the morning. I mean, I listen to talkback radio, sometimes just 702. Sometimes I listen to Today FM or something. And you hear these people who are groveling because they got to get up and go to work. Mondays are the worst days of the week for these people. I think, why do you have a job that you don't like? Why would you keep going to a job you don't like? What's the point of that? You only have, how many years do you have? And you're going to spend how many of those going to a job you hate? That is harsh. I can hear the sound of Kohelet just working for money. But the money is just a mechanism by the which they afford the things that they also want to have. You want to afford the babysitter so that your child can be well tended, rather than your tending to your child, because you've got to work to pay for the babysitter so you can afford the kid a good life. Wait a minute. Something's backwards there. Look at verse 4. A generation comes, a generation goes. It is just a plain old empty return. The earth remains forever. It's not a statement about geology. It is a statement that nothing matters. I've said it already. A generation goes, a generation comes. Nothing's going to change. Nothing I do is changing anything. This is, my impact is futile. I have no measurable noise level. I have no measurable change level. Now, I think he wrote this at a time when he had great power and significance. If you want to really live in this sound, talk today when there are 6 billion people on the planet and you're merely a tax file number. Try to get anyone's attention. Have you ever gotten a parking ticket? Good luck. What do you do with that? What do you do with a parking ticket? Well, you go take a photo. You want to argue, right? Take a photo, send it into the local council. Tell them that they've got it wrong, that you were parked here, 30 meters away. Was that sign? I'm fine. You know? Good luck getting anyone to notice you. And that's just in a local council. Try to make a difference in a generation. One generation comes, another one goes. Your position is insignificant. That's what he's saying. This sounds pretty hopeless. Verse 5, the sun rises and the sun sets, and hastening to its place, it rises there again. This idea of the sun rising and setting and going to its place. We know today that the sun's not moving so much as we are. Although the sun itself is moving, because everything's moving out there. But this idea of hastening, literally panting to its place, sounds really silly. That I'm going slowly through life, barely eking out an existence, but the sun is running to get where it needs to go. But I have no impact on life. The sun's going to get up and the sun's going to set, whether I live or die. Again, a picture of insignificance. Blowing, verse 6, towards the south, then turning towards the north, the wind continues swirling along. On its circular courses, the wind returns. So the wind is doing the same. By the way, the word blowing is not the word blowing, but halach, going. The wind is going towards the south, but then it's savav, it's spinning, just like the savivon, the dreidel, is turning towards the north. The wind continues, savivon, swirling along, and on its circular courses, the wind returns, and there's the word shuv. So, in other words, the wind comes and goes, and boy, didn't we feel that 2 days ago. 95 kilometer an hour gale force winds blowing all over Sydney, and then, just like that, it's over. And I imagine that the writer, Kohelet, might have written just like that on Tuesday. Then all the rivers halach into the sea. So the wind is halaching towards the south, and the rivers are halaching, they're going, they're just going, into the sea. But the sea is not full. What a waste. It's going, but nothing's filling it. What's another word for full? If I said to you, you want some dinner, are you full? What's another word for full? satisfied. There is a dissatisfaction in the sea with the amount of water that's coming to it. And that is a mere analogy or an allegory for the Kohelet about his own life. All these rivers are coming to him, but he's not satisfied. He's got plenty of stuff, juice, things that make other people apparently happy. And like the sea, it's not full. To the place where the rivers flow, again, halach, there they halach again. There's a monotony, isn't there, to the sun rising and setting, the rivers coming and going, one generation coming and going, the wind coming and spinning. You get the picture. Nature is boring. It's the monotony of life. And what's the key word? I think same. It's the sameness of life. Now, to some who love patterns, that's extremely comforting. But most people want a bit of spice of life. What's that? Variety. It's the spice of life. But here we see this painful, monotonous reading. All things, verse 8, are wearisome. That's hard to read, isn't it? Man is not able to tell it. The eye is not satisfied with seeing, nor is the ear filled with hearing. So he's looked at nature, and now he turns to a short poem about his own being. To all people, we're not satisfied. We're not complete. We're not happy. We're not full. And again, that verse 9, that painful monotony, that which has been is that which will be. Same. The same was, is. And that which has been done is that which will be done. So the things that were done are the same things that will be done. Nothing new, tachat hashemesh, under the sun. What's another way to say tachat hashemesh? What's another way, just get out of a literal rendering, under the sun. What's another way to say that? On earth, okay. When we compared in the Gospel of John, we compared supernatural to natural. This is natural. This is human enterprise sans Dieu, without God. This is just by nature, this is what life is like. And there's nothing you or anyone can do about it. It's under the sun. It's nature left to itself to run its course. Verse 10, is there anything of which one might say, aha, this is new? This is so comprehensive, it's dismal. It's existed for ages which were before us. There's no remembrance of earlier things, meaning when things changed, and also of later things which will occur, there for them no remembrance. Nothing's going to be different. So this is the sad cry of a monotonous evaluator of life. I've tried all kinds of things. Absolutely nothing's different. Nothing worked. Tachat Hashemesh. Under the sun. He's talking about natural byproducts of a life spent on yourself. The natural byproduct of a life spent with yourself is you. You become the master, you become the provider, and you, end of the day, look the same, are the same, no matter what else you do. You go buy the same lottery ticket, you drive the same car. Even if you get a new car, it's still a car, and you're sitting in the same driver's seat. Well, what if somebody drives you? You're still sitting in the car, and somebody's driving you. The experience is still, you are on the road. Okay, well, what about an airplane? It's just a big bus. That's all it is. And it goes up in the air and it's got wings, but it's a bus. It's just a mode of transport. And you're going from A to B to C. You're just going somewhere. And at the end, it's still you that you're going with. It's you. So this is what his evaluation is. Verse 12. I, the preacher, have been king over Israel in Jerusalem. What does that say? Not just who he is, but who is he? It's not just that he's Solomon. But what does it say that somebody's a king over Israel in Jerusalem?
Chosen by God.
Good. He's in a chosen place. God's somehow involved. He's related to Israel. My goodness. This is the chosen people. He's in the geographic center of the world. He's in what we would call the action center. He says, ho-hum. Ho-hum. Do you remember the Winnie the Pooh character, Eeyore, who was never happy, never satisfied? Oh, well, I guess I'll just go over here. And he was always sad. You know, people would come along and try to make him happy, his friends, Pooh and all the others, Christopher Robin, they'd all try to, come on, Eeyore, oh, well, you know, you just kind of go along. But unhappily, here's the preacher, Kohelet, who's been king, so he's not just a little guy, he's had every advantage. He's over Israel, so he's got God's advantage. He's in Jerusalem, he's not just on the wayward side, he's in the center of it all. And, here's your verse, I set my mind, verse 13, to seek and explore by wisdom concerning all that's been done under heaven. It's a grievous task. Wait a minute. Wait, I've sought to explore by wisdom? I've wanted every bit of God's information so that I could rule well? And he says, ugh, it's such a grief. Grief, knowledge and wisdom are grief? By the way, this word explore is the same word, latur, that was used of the spies to go explore. Now, spy sounds cool, like James Bond, 007, but it's not that word for spy. And I'm sorry that the people who wrote the English for Numbers chapter 13, Numbers chapter 13, when Moses sent out the spies, translated it as spies. It's not spying. They weren't going in to find out stuff that nobody knew, but they just went in on a scientific exploration, which is why they came back with grapes and said how big the people were and all that. That's the same word here that Solomon says, I set my mind, my heart really, alev, et libi, my heart, to seek, okay, drash, and to explore. That's probably a scientific word, if not more than that, in wisdom or by wisdom concerning all that's been done under heaven. Now, if you have a scientific bent and you can go into the newsagent and pick up any number of Astronomy Today or scientific journals, they abound. There are lots of them and they are good. If you like, you ever watch the Discovery Channel on TV and you see these animals and how cool these are and the camera work to zoom in on these little tiny microscopic animals or these giant, you know, big hippopotami and the gorillas and the things they cover. I love it. I'm fascinated by that. I'm not going to say it's all vanity. I would explore that every day if I could. It's a great watch on TV. But he says it's a grievous task. In fact, the word grievous is ra, meaning wicked task, which God has given to the sons of men, so the Bnei Adam, to be ana, afflicted with, lahanotbo, to be humbled by, to be pained by. Now, what sense is that? That all the information we gain is really purposeless. No. It has a purpose, to humiliate us. Is that what wisdom is for? What's the nature of science? What do you reckon a scientist, what's the first thing a scientist has to do to be a good scientist? Observe, and then do what? Measuring and recording are good, but before you do that, you have to look at something and ask a question. Yeah, so observation leads to questioning, leads to measuring and recording and all these hypotheses by the which you make more conclusions, which give you more observations, which give you more questions. So really, questioning is a major part of the scientific method and of life in general. But he's already answered all the questions he's had with, it's wicked. It's a grievous task. It's useless. It's pointless. In fact, the point is to humble me and annoy me and make my life more miserable. Do you know people like this? Have you met people like this? Who, no matter what you tell them, their answer is Eeyore? Yeah, I do too. The wisdom that he sought, God gave him. But it wasn't for the sake of cursing him. It was for the sake of life. Verse 14, Ra'iti, I have seen all the works which have been done under the sun. Those are events. Those are chasing the wind, I guess, striving after wind, he says, and hevel, it's all vanity. That's his favorite term for this. He's looking at all the events of the world, all the stuff that make it up, and says, useless. Now, to be fair, there are some boring parts of life. I get that. But have you walked on the beach lately? Have you seen the sculptures by the sea? Have you gone to see those? Those are out now. They just started. You might want to take a walk there before next week's Bible class. Take an hour walk, Bondi to Bronte, or just Tamarama to Bronte, and see a bunch. And don't just look at the sculptures. Turn and look at the shore and say, our God is pretty awesome. He made everything. He made that shoreline. He made the guy who made this sculpture. He made stuff. And if you take a moment and turn away from what man has made and see what God has made and think who made that and why he made it, you won't come to the same conclusion that Solomon did, that it's all hevel and chasing after the wind. Ura'ut ruach. What's crooked can't be straightened. What's lacking can't be counted. It's all sad, isn't this? If I wanted to be suicidal, I could just read chapter 1 of Ecclesiastes. We'll see it again in chapter 7, but...
Do you think that this is because of his behavior that he's so depressed?
Yeah, what happens when you know the right thing to do and don't do it? What happens when you've had the Word of God come to you, you've had a godly father like King David, you've had information bestowed, you've got righteous people around you, as well as some others, and you say, tell you what, I'm going to take 1,000 wives and concubines. I'm going to have a whole lot of fun. I'm going to have a lot of financial things go on. I'm going to get cedars from Lebanon. I'm going to get gold from all around the world. The Queen of Sheba's coming. I think I'll have a good time with her. I think I'll get all her bounty that she's bringing. Yeah, and once you get away from what you know to be true in God, then you don't know what is true. And if you don't know what's true, you don't have life. So the monotony of life is not that life is monotonous, but that you've dismissed the very reason that life exists. And we're going to see that as we get to our eighth lesson. Life is found in God. The Proverbs, which Solomon wrote, says, riches makes itself wings and flies away. And it's like a mirage. Mm-hmm. I think that all the satisfiers of life are like that. The things that are on the sides of buses and that I get in my email inbox every day that promise me all the great things of life if I will only give them my credit card number and buy something. If I just go to that concert or get that part of my body enlarged, if this comes to me and if I will just purchase that weekend trip to Bali, then my life will be full. And you're right, it's just another high that they're experiencing, or they want you to experience. Now, to be fair, have you gone to Bali? Have you had a ticket to a show? Have you gone to something and you say, that is really cool, that was a lot of fun? But if you think that's where life is supposed to be, you miss out. I said to myself, verse 16, I've magnified and increased wisdom. I've made wisdom gadol, great, big, more than all who were over Jerusalem before me. And my mind has observed a wealth of wisdom and da'at. So both chokhmah and da'at. And what that means is that I'm getting both information and the capacity to absorb it. I'm getting both academics. I'm at the university. I'm at the grad school. I'm in my PhD program. I've got everything. And I've been in a social way to consider things. And what's the most famous story that we remember of King Solomon and wisdom? Mm-hmm. Yeah, the baby. The baby and the two mothers. And what does he do? He gains the wisdom that he needed so that he says, tell you what, let's take the kid and kill it. And the mother, the real mother, said, no, let the other woman have her. Let's have the child. And that's how Solomon knew. He was given wisdom to deal with such a circumstance so early on in his royal career. Chokhmah. So I set my mind to know it. I've observed it. See? And now I know both wisdom and folly, but this also is chasing after wind. Because the more you know, verse 18, there's more grief. There's more downside. And increasing knowledge results in increasing machov, more pain. This idea, the more you know you don't know. The more you know about life, the more things you see that should not be there. The more you know how people should behave, the more you see how people misbehave. And that is painful. He says, I'd rather not know anything. I was better off before I knew anything. This is a monotonous hopelessness that will be, hang in there with us, that will be contrasted with the fear of God and keeping His commandments and finding real life. So if you're listening online and you think that's all the book is, please don't commit suicide. Come back next week. We're going, no, serious. You've got to have disqualifiers. You've got to see that all those things, his academic pursuits, his wisdom pursuits, his gaining of advantage, are mere trivial pursuits. And we're going to talk much more about those in the weeks to come. I go to trivia on once a week at the local pub. And it was so funny. The other night, some fellow joined us. He's about my age. And he just randomly sat at our table with his 23-year-old daughter. And there were seats at our table. And I said, would you like to join us? He said, oh, for trivia. I mean, the trivia is happening in the pub. There are 100 people doing it. And they just came in for an evening meal. And all of a sudden, he got into it. He is yelling, I know the answer. And he's really into it. And at the end of the night, I said, you know, it's called trivia. Okay, so you know who sang that song in 1982. But at the end, who cares? I didn't say that to him. All I said was, it's trivia. And what we have to do is sort out what's trivial and what's really meaningful. And if you miss it, then you're going to summarize everything as vanity of vanities, the most vain thing there is, and you'll be chasing after wind. But we've got the hope that's found in Yeshua.
You've been listening to the Bible class of Jews for Jesus in Australia. For more information, contact Jews for Jesus, Post Office Box 925, Sydney, Australia 2001. God bless you.